From WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard, produced with the support of 1, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, a blueprint for Kentucky kids, a home for very young parents, and the history revealed in an 8-mile stretch of a Kentucky creek. First, if you want to check on what condition our condition is in, look no further than that of our children. And a good place to look for that information is the website of Kentucky Youth Advocates and their Kids Count Data Center. It's a rich resource of all the latest stats on everything you want to know about our kids here in the Commonwealth, their health, their education, their safety, their family situations. Kentucky Youth Advocates is led by Terry Brooks, and he joins us for a look at the organization's policy priorities for 2019. Greetings, Dr. Brooks.
Hey, Tom. Thank you so much for being here and spotlighting kids.
Your organization, in partnership with other groups across the state, has published a blueprint for Kentucky's children, and it lays out a dozen legislative and administrative priorities for our policymakers and legislators to consider. And each set of issues is followed by a suggested solution, and these priorities rest on 3 pillars, which seems like a good starting place. Can you tell us what those are?
Sure. Tom, first of all, thanks for highlighting the blueprint. Several years ago, we took a challenge from the General Assembly that said that even if they wanted to be champions for children, we can't bring them 200 diverse recommendations every year. They challenged KYA to quarterback a process where we would bring literally hundreds of children's champions together and try on an annual basis to think through consensus priorities. And as you mentioned, those priorities are really organized around the themes of thriving communities, strong families, and successful kids. So what we try to do each year within the blueprint is say, if Kentucky wants to have thriving communities, strong families, and successful kids, what are the key issues that need to move in Frankfort during, for instance, the 2019 session? We use the Kids Count data. We certainly use on-the-ground experiences that many partners bring to the table. We're very upfront in talking to lawmakers about feasibility as well as priorities. And then, as you said, we try to come out with a fairly focused, synthesized list of here are the imperatives for 2019.
Okay, and I know that all the priorities that you've identified are quite vital, and the full list, by the way, for our listeners can be found on the Kentucky Youth Advocates site, which is kyyouth.org. We're limited in time here, so I would like to ask you to highlight what you consider to be the burning issues that really demand immediate attention.
Yeah, I think there's maybe 3 themes that would be the priorities. One is that a key movement from last session was around the fundamental reform of child welfare. That is an arena that, if there is anything bipartisan in Frankfort these days, it is around child welfare. Both chambers, and Democrats and Republicans, seem to be together on that. We want to make sure that that momentum continues, that efforts like expanding kinship care, trying to ensure family preservation, that those continue. There is a wonderful opportunity because of key federal legislation called the Family First Prevention Service Act, a long title, but it's very much aligned with the efforts that are at play in Kentucky. And we see that as a really important arena that we can keep the momentum going. The second area that candidly probably offers some partisan differences is around justice, both the criminal justice system, where we know that Kentucky has the second highest rate in the nation of incarcerated parents, and juvenile justice, where again, momentum began a few years ago with Senate Bill 200, sort of started looking at who do we lock up and why do we lock kids up and what could we do to both protect community safety but also help kids. That's an arena that is absolutely essential. And finally, the one that that kind of has surprised me, that has taken on really interesting life, is around tobacco policy and how that's impacted kids. The 2 threads there are we know that about half the kids in Kentucky attend schools that are tobacco-free. We really believe that we're at a point in the Commonwealth where we need to say that every school campus is tobacco-free. And the other one, as a grandpa, not just of eight kids, but of two teenagers, and I had a conversation just this week with them about this, is that we have become so painfully aware that we are experiencing an e-cig explosion,
mm-hmm.
not for 18-year-olds, but for 10- and 12-year-olds. And so we, partnering with a number of groups, especially the Foundation for Healthy Kentucky, believe that that's an arena that, again, we can get movement on in 2019 to better protect kids from the negative impact of electronic products. And so child welfare, the justice system, and health, specifically as it's applied to that longtime Kentucky issue of tobacco, seem to be three areas that are really important. There are certainly a number of other arenas, such as we think that the special working group this fall out of Frankfurt has done a really remarkable job around school safety. There are a number of areas in that school safety issue that we believe will be at play. So those are the sort of the mm-hmm. headlines as we go into a short non-budget session in a year where there's a governor's race. So we know those are some fences that we're going to have to climb over, the length of the session, no money on the table. And I'm just guessing that perhaps the governor's race may not increase kumbaya feelings in Frankfurt. So we're addressing those straight up, trying to find those areas where we talk about common ground, common gumption, and common good, and we hope that every policy priority we're putting out there meets those three criteria.
Okay. I want to touch on some of those issues that you've raised in the short amount of time we have. First of all, on a recent edition of Eastern Standard, we talked about the impact of the opioid addiction epidemic on children, and specifically how it has weighed so heavily on foster and kinship care. Can you talk to us about why support of kinship families is among your priorities for 2019?
Absolutely. We have seen kinship care in Kentucky accelerate so quickly in the last 4 or 5 years. As we talk today, almost 100,000 children are living with relatives. We know a number of factors drive children going to out-of-home placement. Poverty is one, incarceration is one, and the opioid epidemic, which certainly invades both poverty and incarceration, is a major lever for that. Unfortunately, I don't think that landscape of poverty and the way we do justice in Kentucky and the opioid epidemic, that's not going to go away tomorrow. So we're going to continue to have little boys and little girls who can't stay with mom and dad, and we have to think about, so what? We know that in many cases, I'm never going to say in every case, but in most cases, staying with a grandma or a grandpa or an aunt or an uncle is the next best thing to being home. And the other thing that's such a powerful thing around kinship is it's not only good for the kid, it is great for the state budget, because kinship is a much less costly but much more effective proposition than, for instance, residential care. I think conceptually, leaders in Kentucky believe in kinship care. Candidly, I think we have to do a lot more, both in Frankfurt and in local communities, to boost that concept. For instance, kinship families flat out need additional financial resources. Foster parents get reimbursement, and I don't think anybody has questions about why that's essential. We need to make sure that kinship families receive adequate financial support from Frankfurt to take on the challenge of raising kids. But kinship is also one, Tom, that I don't think we can simply delegate to Frankfurt. And I'll give you an example. We know that in states where kinship is done in the best way possible, respite care is provided, which we do for foster care, meaning that every so often somebody comes in and takes care of those youngins so that that grandma can get away alone, whether that's to go shopping or go to church for a meeting or just have a cup of coffee. Until Kentucky gets a lot more resources than we have, that's an idea, for instance, that I'm really animated. What could local communities do if we as a commonwealth really want to embrace kinship care? We absolutely have to ask some support from our elected leaders, no question about that. But we can't simply cop out as local communities and say it all has to come from Frankfurt. Raising kids after you've already raised your kids mentally, physically, and emotionally is a tough business.
It sure is.
We owe it. And I'm going to say that again with capital letters. We owe it to those grandparents and other relatives to support them in big ways and small ways if they're willing to take on that challenge.
Dr. Brooks, we are quickly running out of time, but I wanted to make sure that we touched on this other subject before we have to wrap it up, and that is e-cigs, which you referred to earlier. Kentucky Youth Advocates and the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky recently trotted out some pretty eye-opening statistics on this issue. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, what we have found is that the use of electronic devices by young people, especially young people, 10 and 12 years old, middle school kids, has exploded in the last 3 or 4 years. We've seen, for instance, the advertising dollars usually delivered through social media from e-cig purveyors. You know, it's increasing 1,000% each year. They know what they're doing. There's a lot of medical evidence and hard data, and we certainly look at that. I was fascinated that KYA conducted focus groups around the state, including a couple in eastern Kentucky. And what we heard from young people was, first of all, the use is rampant. Secondly, they get the fact that when e-cigs are marketed as having flavors like cotton candy and grape slush, that's not aimed, Tom, to you and me. That marketing is aimed to young kids. The young people themselves basically asserted that their parents and teachers don't have a clue. In talking to teachers and parents, they confirmed, we really don't know what's going on. The other thing is that young people, in many young people who are using e-cigs, don't know that it's harmful. They don't see it as a gateway product to tobacco use. So if you look back in time, some of the same marketing that tobacco companies used in the 50s and early 60s, be cool, doesn't hurt you, what a deal, same thing's going on today. Hopefully we have picked up on the radar of this issue. I've been encouraged that when we talk to legislators, they get it because they see it in their hometowns and they hear about it from parents. So we really believe that some common sense safeguards, some guardrails can be put up so that we can protect young people from getting hooked on that particular product.
Well, Dr. Brooks, we have only scratched the surface of the blueprint that your organization has provided for 2019. I only wish we had time to go into all of these topics, and we will over the coming months. I'd like to revisit them. But for now, I would urge our listeners to go to kyyouth.org, and there you can see the whole thing and really dig into it. Terry Brooks, Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll revisit again.
Super. Thanks, Tom.
Coming up after the break, still not quite an adult yourself, you become a parent, you're alone, and you need help. That's next. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019 in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Although young adults are less likely to be parents today than in the past, many young adults, those ages 18 to 26, do become parents. And young people in this age range are more likely to become parents than people in any other age group. About half of all first births are to women age 26 or younger. While some young parents thrive personally and are very good moms and dads, the challenges facing young parents are often great, and the stakes during these years are high both for them and for their young children. And that's recognized here in Kentucky in the form of the Scholar House. Here to tell us about this resource for young single parents is Melissa Gross, director of Eastern Scholar House here in Richmond. Thanks for joining us, Melissa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And first, a little bit of background. If you could tell us about the Scholar House initiative. It's statewide, I understand.
Yes. We have 11 Scholar Houses spread out from Western Kentucky to we're about the furthest east right now. And the Scholar House idea is stemming from a conglomeration of many different people and investors and interested parties. Kentucky Housing Corporation is sort of spearheading that as the organizer in Kentucky, and they have come together for several years. But for us, we are just in our about 18th month of this, so we're very new to the Scholar House initiative.
Okay. I'm sure it's a pretty long and detailed story, but if you could give us the elevator version of how this initiative got going to begin with?
Well, sure. Our executive director at the time, Vicki Josefowicz with Kentucky River Foothills, saw this as an opportunity, as we all would, to invest in two generations at a time. We love that we can see parents and their children together working toward self-sufficiency. That's our ultimate goal, to help them reach. And Vicki began working on that, she will tell you, about 10 years ago, trying to find the right environment to be able to build the structure. How do you put together this kind of financing? All the different partners that had to come together and what that had to look like within our community and our area. This Scholar House is designed for the regional area of eastern side of Kentucky. So many different partnerships had to come together, and she is the brains behind this operation.
And who is it meant for, and what is it trying to address? What are the problems it solves?
Sure. So Eastern Scholar House, as well as all Scholar Houses, are designed to bring in low-income, single parents ready to go to school and committed to that work, committed to that time management, committed to all that it takes to make this happen. So we have said many times that there's lots of apartments in Kentucky. There are many, many schools in Kentucky. There are several daycares in any area. But what we saw as an opportunity was to bring those into a closer proximity of each other. And then what we added is this case management. And I'm definitely a believer in the idea of case management. And for us, that means when a family sees a barrier pop up, who do they talk that through? How do they keep that barrier from moving them into a mode of, I can't do this, and helping them to see that they can do this and how they overcome each one of those barriers. And so really, it's a lot of things that we already had going for us in Kentucky, no question, but we just added that case management, and it's like, I'm going to see that person. There is a face-to-face person that I can see and talk through whatever barrier might be popping up to cause me to think I can't finish school when we want them to finish.
So am I right in saying that what this does is it consolidates these key programs under one roof within close proximity of one another so they can integrate and support one another, the programs, that is?
Exactly. Very well said, yes.
What criteria has to be met to be accepted for this program?
We take questionnaires for our entry-level conversations. That actually has a small essay attached to it. It has an interview attached to it. Because we can gather the facts. We can figure out that you are low income. That's an obvious number. We know that you are a single parent. Those are the very things that are just data-driven. We know that. But we really have to have those conversations that lets us know they are committed to the program, they are open to case management, they are interested in having life skills brought into their families, they are interested in good, strong education, we look for good work ethic, And so we are trying to find those information points even outside of a true questionnaire. We need to know what interests them, what inspires them, and what will keep them on the track. It's what we're hoping to uncover.
How many families can you house at a time at your facility?
We have 39 two-bedroom apartments, and that would be our capacity.
What's a typical day like then for a resident family from breakfast on?
A typical good day or a typical tough day?
So let's have one of each.
One of each, sure. The typical good day is we got up on time because our alarm worked, and we had the child to the Child Development Center by 7:30 or 8 o'clock. We went on to our first class and maybe even to our next class, went on to our work assignment, and were able to fit in a lunch in there. Got 2 hours of study time, finished the last class, picked up the child between 4:30, 5:30, went home, made dinner, got baths, put the child to bed, and went on and studied probably a little bit more, and hoping they can then go to sleep at that time.
Okay, that sounds very perfect.
Isn't that perfect? That's exactly what we want every day to be. But unfortunately, many times those days look like something like it went that way until 9 o'clock and someone at the child development center calls and says, your child has a fever. You went to class and they say, this class now is going to add 2 evening events that you must attend. You went to your work assignment and they needed you to stay an extra hour, but it overlapped with something else. So it's those things that seem kind of small, but it goes off in a, it causes your life to go off in a very different direction than you planned for. So when you can get all of that back together and you get home and the car starts, you've really accomplished something. I call them my overachievers because what they have to do with time management and problem solving is new every day.
Is somebody working with them through these problems to make it clear that this is life? The previous scenario that you described, not so much.
Right. Well, we hope that we are working through them. We may not know every detail of what happened in that day. Some we do. Some we see on an everyday basis. But we hope that we are encouraging them to have good skills. What is the appropriate reaction to that? We can solve this, and some things will move into the next day before I'll actually get them accomplished. When is it time to have a different path taken? You know, when is it time to see that this is a small barrier and that there aren't very many large barriers? So those small barriers you can jump over. What's this hurdle? We can manage this one. And so we hope that we're giving them good life skills and lots of good ways to handle their family dynamics that gets them through to the next day and on to success.
Going back to that age range that I mentioned a few minutes ago, in particular the 18 to 24 range, and especially on the lower end of that range, late teens, early 20s, you're seeing young parents here who are still developing themselves, yet they have responsibility now for children who are developing. That would seem to present a pretty unique challenge.
It does. There is something I think that we're lucky that sort of kicks into your brain when you become a mother or a father. I don't know where they come from, these excellent skills, but you know, we have a young lady coming right out of high school, 18 years old, and has a new child and first time she's lived away from home. So there's many different things to work through besides just the education side of it and being a success. So when we can recognize, just as you said, there's brain development going on in 2 different people here. And what when we meet them at 18 and when they're probably done with us at 22 or 23, they'll look completely different, won't they? We hope that they will. And as the child will. And we hope that we are recognizing that and what that looks like for adult learners, and how the brain is continuing to most of the time help us, and sometimes it can be tired and needs a little boost in some encouragement.
Kentucky Youth Advocates and the Annie E. Casey Foundation recently released a new Kids Count policy report. It's titled Opening Doors for Young Parents. And it notes that young fathers are often left out of programs that support young families. Can more be done to involve these young men? And what do you all do?
Absolutely. There needs to be a different and a better outreach for our young men. We have had very few men to reach out to us for this. I can count four. We don't have any men within our program at all right now. We have some very good fathers who may not be in a relationship with the mother, but we do not have any men living within our program right now. And, you know, of those four that came, they all went another direction because luckily they found employment that allowed them to make a little more, and it just would not work into the whole system that they were doing. They decided they would go to part-time school. So it's a real challenge for these men who are doing the single parent walk. It's and it's interesting. We don't really know what the numbers are. That's a data point that is pretty loose right now all across America and our schools, that we may not understand how many men as well as women are needing that kind of assistance. We sort of know how many are student parents because they can tell us that they have a dependent at home. We know how many are filing as head of household, but we don't often capture the data of what those children's ages are. And so how many of them need to have some outside influence come into them, and how many of them are holding down an excellent job and are just trying to walk into some post-secondary education. And that data really needs to be better collected across America.
So you've been at this for about 18 months at Eastern Scholar House, a little too soon yet to talk about outcomes from your facility, but I'm sure you've watched what's happened at other facilities across the state. Anything come to mind that stands out in terms of outcomes?
The ultimate outcome is designed to just be self-sufficiency. We want these parents to be able to walk away and say, I have a job that is strong enough to support my family, and I don't need any of the government resources that were coming to me before, such as food stamps or KTAP or any of those other programs that were supporting low-income families. We want them to not be a low-income family anymore. And then ideally, we want the second generation to not need that as well, so that they're continuing to be the next generation of college graduates. And we hope that that is the pattern that we will see. You can attend other events that the other scholar houses hold, and they will always have testimonials of what this meant for them, what it meant to be able to have a community of other parents around them, friends that they made, just the encouragement that comes from knowing there's 38 other people in this complex that are trying to accomplish the same thing I'm doing.
Do you enjoy this work, Melissa?
I very much enjoy this work. It's
Why?
A great blessing.
What about it?
Well, if you meet my families over there individually, they're all very inspiring. They are very tough. They know what it takes to get to the point that they want to be on the other side. They make goals. They know how they're going to get to those goals. And they work hard every day to make their family see that there is a way to come out the other side and be better for that. And so a lot of very smart, inspiring young ladies we have over there.
Melissa Gross is director of Eastern Scholar House in Richmond. Thanks for being with us, Melissa.
Thank you.
You'll find a downloadable fact sheet about Eastern Scholar House on our site at esweku.com. Just click on the Facts and Information tab.
Cold, lazy wind that blows straight through your busted soul. Fast food stinks and hangs in your coat as you try to take refuge from the brutal cold. There's a place down south where a warm sea breeze kisses your face, standing in freezing shoes, me and you.
So it's winter now, and if this time of year finds you commiserating with Chris Rea's deep winter blues, you may have something called SAD. That's short for seasonal affective disorder. It's a mood malady, a kind of depression that happens at the same time every year, usually in winter. One workaround is lifestyle change. That's according to Murray State University psychology professor Michael Bordieri. He says seasonal affective disorder is caused by many different factors, including genetics and environment. Lack of sunlight was long thought to be a cause, but he says that's been ruled out by studies in the 90s and early 2000s. Researchers looking into the proportion of people with seasonal depression in Norway, where winter is experienced for the majority of the year.
You know, the place where you would expect to see even more clear evidence of the seasonal pattern of depression wasn't really showing up in those studies.
Dr. Bordieri says Nordic and Scandinavian countries use lifestyle change as the frontline prevention technique for seasonal depression.
Simply sort of altering your lifestyle to make sure that you can stay active and sort of build activities even in the winter months when the days are shorter, it gets colder, and maybe you want to kind of hunker down a bit more.
Here's something worth noting.
Women are particularly susceptible, much more so than men.
Kelly Rowan is a professor of psychology at the University of Vermont who researches seasonal affective disorder.
At least two times the number of women as men suffer from seasonal affective disorder. It also looks like younger adults are more susceptible, people in their 20s or their 30s. People who live at a high latitude are particularly susceptible. Although it does exist in Florida, it's relatively rare compared to, for example, where I am, Burlington, Vermont.
The really big question is why?
That's the million-dollar question. Everybody reports this gender difference in seasonal depression, but nobody really explains why. In non-seasonal depression, women are more likely than men to ruminate. And this is a repetitive thinking style, focusing on the causes and consequences of your depression. This seems to make women particularly vulnerable to develop depression. Rumination increases risk of depression. It makes depression more severe when it begins. So I suspect that there's something about rumination in terms of potentially explaining the gender difference in winter depression, although that's an empirical question, and I hope somebody does the study to find out.
Does it help to head for a sunny beach somewhere? Well, there's good news and bad news.
Oh, it most definitely does. My word of caution about doing that has to do with reentry. So people with seasonal affective disorder uniformly say that they feel so much better when they travel to a warm, sunny location. And it's almost immediate. Within a few days of getting there, they feel great. They feel like they do in the summer. However, we have to then go back to wherever you're coming from, farther north, and that reentry can be pretty jarring for the biological clock.
Dr. Rowan was interviewed by Jeremy Hobson on NPR's Here and Now out of Boston, where they know winter.
There's a place down south where a warm sea breeze kisses your face, standing in freezing shoes.
Looking ahead to next week's edition of Eastern Standard, the antidote to parachute journalism.
Where editors from larger markets like New York, L.A., San Francisco, and D.C. parachute in reporters to write about smaller communities and towns across the country.
Lexington-based journalist Sarah Baird, creator of Shoe Leather, a web-based resource that connects big city assignment editors with local reporters who know the score. We'll be joined by one of them, Jonathan Green, editor of the Richmond Register, and we'll talk with Aaron Thompson, the new president of the Council on Post-Secondary Education. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through the 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
We're back on Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin, and we're talking with former Kentucky Poet Laureate, Transylvania University English professor, author, and admitted topophiliac, Richard Taylor. He has written more than a dozen books, and they include Sue Mundy, Gertie, and Earth Bones. The cover of his latest, published by the University Press of Kentucky, sports the Thomas D. Clark Medallion. In Elkhorn, Evolution of a Kentucky Landscape, Dr. Taylor offers a snapshot of the economic, social, and cultural transformation of Kentucky captured within an 8-mile stretch of Elkhorn Creek, from the forks of Elkhorn to Knight's Bridge. And as fellow Kentucky author Eric Reese put it, he does so with a poet's eye and a historian's curiosity. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Taylor.
Happy to be here.
First, topophilia or topophilia, whichever it is. I just want to assure our listeners that it is not a malady, far from it, that you are okay, and that many Kentuckians have it. Could you elaborate on what that is?
Topophilia is a term that was coined by the poet W. H. Auden, and it means basically place and love of place. And that, as you mentioned, I think most Kentuckians would identify with that.
So let's get our bearings before we dive into the book. Where exactly is the section of the creek that is the focus of your book?
The section of the creek that is the focus of my book is it begins on Highway 460, where it crosses at a place called the Forks of Elkhorn. The Forks of Elkhorn, geographically, is the convergence of the South and North Forks of Elkhorn Creek. It formed the main stem of Elkhorn Creek, which runs approximately, 12 or 16 miles to the Kentucky River. Elkhorn is the second largest tributary of the Kentucky River.
And it had become something of a touchstone for you personally. Why is that?
It is that because when I took a job at Kentucky State University in 1975, I bought an old house that I began to discover a lot of historical connections.
And this is the Giltner Holt House. Correct?
The Giltner Holt House. Mm-hmm. And among the things I learned was that history began at my doorstep, an 1870 newspaper article. Mentioned the capture of two slaves in the front who were cutting wood in the front yard during the last major Indian foray into Franklin County, which occurred in 1792, the year of statehood. And from that, from my doorstep, I discovered that the person who originally owned the property was the first federal judge west of the mountains. His name was Harry Innes. He was an immigrant from Virginia and was very prominent in the formation, not only the formation of Frankfort as the state's capital, but also Kentucky as a state. He was one of the persons who attended the 8 or 10 conventions that resulted in Kentucky statehood.
Do you ever stand there and imagine the voices of people from the past and the activities that happened there?
I do. That area, that 8-mile stretch, is fraught with history. An Indian massacre, a major early industrial complex with the Stedman paper mill, Paul Sawyer associations. The book contains lots of references to the local history, and I think about it often. I think most often, I guess, about Sawyer himself, who knew that creek and documented it perhaps more fully than any state in Kentucky, at least in terms of painting.
And how far from your house is Elkhorn Creek? Can you actually see it?
I can see the bluffs above Elkhorn Creek, the Palisades above Elkhorn Creek from my lower hill. So as the crow flies, maybe three-quarters of a mile, but it's a clear shot across that valley, which the Elkhorn Valley, of course, is the product of eons of erosion. And so on my lower hill, I can look straight out and see what was formerly a piece of property that was contiguous to mine before the valley was carved out.
And what is it about the creek and this landscape that you describe that spoke to you in a way that inspired you to write about it in an historical context?
Visibly, Elkhorn is fairly pristine. It's pristine because around it, the banks around it are either agricultural or undevelopable. So when I kayak down Elkhorn Creek, I can go with a sense of following Boone's prow, so to speak. It is timbered. It is relatively wild. And relatively peopleless, except for the persons who fish there and kayak there, and a few people along the edges who farm it.
It's difficult in a brief radio interview to do full justice to a book. So instead of attempting that, I'd like to ask you to tease our imaginations, if you will, by touching on some random chapters. And one that comes to mind is The Ones Who Came Before.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, there used to be a standing view that Native Americans never really lived in Kentucky. And that fact, that contention is utterly untrue. Native Americans have lived on the creek since the end of the last ice age, from about 12,000 years ago until about, let's say, 1750, when Euro-Americans came into Kentucky, mostly from the east.
Another chapter that really captured my eye was the Cook Massacre. What happened there?
Well, the Cook Massacre, unlike many tales of the frontier, highlighted women. Two heroic women withstood an attack of 100 or so Wyandot Indians who had shot their husbands, and they barricaded themselves in a cabin. They managed to shoot one of the attackers. Interestingly enough, that attacker's body was placed in the creek. It floated a mile and a half or 2 miles and lodged itself on an enormous piece of limestone, which is still to this day known as Indian Rock.
Hmm. And the entrepreneur of the Elkhorn?
A.W. Macklin is one probably, and I don't have statistics to back this up, but he was probably at his death in 1863, one of the wealthiest men in Kentucky. He was the son of an Irish immigrant. It's a great American success story. He owned not and created, really, not only three mills on the creek, but owned a vast amount of real estate, a slaughterhouse in Frankfort, a coal operation which had its roots in eastern Kentucky. He was truly an entrepreneur of the captains of industry mold.
Elkhorn is illustrated by numerous photographs, paintings, portraits, even your own sketch of your home. In fact, it's fun just to flip through just to get a visual sense of where we're talking about and who we're talking about. Of course, we're on the radio, so no picture here. So, listener, you have to pick up the book and do what I did and turn through its pages to appreciate what I'm talking about. But, Dr. Taylor, I wonder if you could comment on your choices of imagery.
Well, those chapters that center on individuals, I simply went to what existing images there were, including portraits from the Speed Museum of Harry Innes and his wife, photographs where they existed in the files, say, of the Frankfurt History Museum, the City Museum as well. In a few cases, I had to look pretty hard. There are very few depictions, for instance, of the first comers that we talked about. What did these people who lived along Elkhorn look like? We don't know the name of a single one of them. We don't have an image, an accurate image of any of them. So I had to kind of extrapolate and find faces that I could imagine living along the creek.
We're talking with Richard Taylor, author of Elkhorn, Evolution of a Kentucky Landscape. In your book, you talk about Elkhorn Creek as an inspiration for many forms of creativity and art. What art forms have been inspired by this place?
Well, as I mentioned, Paul Sawyer, of mm-hmm. course, who is the dean, perhaps, of Kentucky painters, at least 19th and early 20th century painters. But he's inspired a number of people who come and do plein air painting along the creek. And I won't trouble you with their names. Well, Ellen Glasgow, Betty Beshore, or Karen Carey are friends whom I know regularly paint along the creek. But it's also been an inspiration just for people to reflect. I'm convinced that the fishermen who come to Elkhorn Creek come as much to escape the distractions of urban and urban living as they do to catch fish. And so that's inspired poetry. It's inspired, I guess, to some degree, fiction. It's certainly been a rich source of historical research.
And shortly we'll get to a piece of art that inspired you. But first, I want to ask you about an observation that I came across in the book by David Orr. Begins a chapter. Mm-hmm. And if I may, he comments that liberal arts education that involves a familiarity with nature would teach students that there are some things that just can't be said about a mountain or a forest or a river, things too subtle or too powerful to be caught in the net of science, language, and intellect. It would introduce students to the mysterious and unknowable before the mere unknowns of a particular discipline. You're an educator, so I assume you included that for that reason. But could you elaborate on it?
Actually, that passage by David Orr was from a book I was teaching to my freshman students in the freshman seminar, and it's called Earth in Mind. And the idea is that we are surrounded by mystery, and I guess characteristically of the Western mind, we don't really probe into things that aren't tangible. We're very comfortable talking about the material world, but we've done very little to explore the mysteriousness that David Orr is referring to there. And it might mean a recreation of the lives of people who live there. It might mean the multitude of forces that engender life along the creek and the incredibly intricate relationships between, for instance, organisms in the creek and the lives of others along the creek. One of the major thrusts of the book that pricked my conscience was the environmental issues. Elkhorn Creek, though it looks pristine, in fact is not. And its waters are very carefully monitored. Some of the aquatic life there has been affected by both runoff and effluence from major cities to which Elkhorn is connected, including Georgetown and Lexington. So That's a major concern of mine, as it was in the course I taught, environmental issues and how we too often unknowingly become complicit in the degradation of natural places.
I wish we had more time. There's so much we could talk about. I know that that many people in this region, in our listening area, are familiar with the Elkhorn, or if they're not and hear this, they're going to be. Of course, I guess that could be a concern as well. But I wonder if you could leave us with a reading from your book, perhaps the Feast of Silence, if you would.
Happy to. There are a couple of poems in the book, and this is one of them. The Feast of Silence. Rounding the bend of Elkhorn, I see the first angler, solitary, standing motionless, waist deep in green water, shafts of saffron light falling short of the shade in which he swishes his fly across the stillness, air about him laden with an aqua muzziness in which dust motes seem suspended. Around the next, I see more of their number, a pair in a fishing kayak drawn off the cove, another in a floppy hat hunkered at the water's edge on a sloping stone that must have fallen from the cliffs above before the first keel scraped Plymouth Rock. Lost in fisher reveries, the brief reprieve from jobs, the raucous levees of family, they do not seem too anxious for the catch so much as to feed a patient hunger. Content to hold place their lives on hold, they pause like the dragonfly lighting on the knuckle of one paddle hand to take in the drooping limbs, the scree of an invisible hawk, the white knot of roots on the sycamore whose falling leaves are riddled to gauze by insects. These things that can never be summed but only relished as a meal more substantial than fish, a stay beyond the creek against the hard symmetries of the world, beyond the incessant drone of traffic and scrapings of famished souls, as they feel themselves replenished, feeding on this feast of silence.
Dr. Richard Taylor, reading The Feast of Silence. Dr. Taylor, we appreciate your time. He is the author of Elkhorn, Evolution of a Kentucky Landscape, published by the University Press of Kentucky, and thank you for being with us.
Tom, thank you.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of ONE, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our chief production engineer and editor. Colin Overton, editor-in-chief of the EKU campus paper Eastern Progress, is our intern. Eastern Standard's growing list of content partners includes WEKU News, the Ohio Valley Resource, the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, Kentucky Humanities, the Kentucky Historical Society, the Lexington Herald Leader, the Richmond Register, Undermain, the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series, the Transylvania University Creative Intelligence Lecture Series. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.